Chapter 3. Difficult Times. Spit on your hands and take a fresh halt. Early saying. 1. The little provisions which the settlers had provided was soon spent, their flour entirely, remembered Ichabod Nye. Very few had laid in any salted meat of any description. The season for venison was gone by. Turkey scarce, beef and cattle, there was none. Ichabod Nye, from the Bay State, had been among those settlers who arrived the first summer. The son-in-law of General Benjamin Tupper, he had made the overland journey with the general and the rest of the family, including his wife, Minerva, and their children, and had had an extremely hard time almost from the start. He wished he had never agreed to go west, for the long and unknown adventure to a wilderness among savages and prowlers of the forest. But of this he said nothing. I never made one word of complaint. The die was cast, and I made the best of it. At Cimarron's Ferry, where the others tarried 10 days, while a boat was made ready, he was charged with driving a stock of 20 worn-out horses through the wilderness on the Virginia shore of the Ohio to Marietta, a task such as he had never before undertaken or even imagined. On arrival, he had been appropriately greeted by Rufus Putnam, but he would not have gotten by until the arrival of the family had it not been for a new acquaintance named Dean Tyler, who had a cabin on the east side of Campus Martius, which he offered to share in return for help with his patch of corn and cucumbers. Tyler, too, was from Massachusetts, a Harvard graduate who had come west as a way of coping with the death of a young lady with whom he had been much in love. If most agreeable in manner and known to be brilliant of mind, he was also thought a bit eccentric, the sort who had been exclusively confined to handling books and found it difficult to become familiar with the axe handle and the hoe. And as Ichabod Nye soon learned, he and Tyler were to subsist mainly on their meager corn and cucumber production. With the arrival of Nye's wife and children, they, too, moved into the Tyler cabin. When in November the shortage of food had become all too apparent, Tyler, with funds provided by the Ohio Company, acquired a flatboat and set off upstream to Pittsburgh for a supply of flour. But then the river froze. Tyler was stranded at Pittsburgh, and at Marietta, as Nye wrote, we were all starving for bread. The fortunes and fate of the settlement, it had become increasingly clear, were much at the sufferance of La Belle Riviere. General Tupper and his family, meanwhile, established themselves in one of the houses within Campus Martius, or the Stockade, as it was commonly known, and were making do as best they could. The general became actively engaged with Rufus Putnam in the management and interests of the Ohio Company, but had suffered severely from the economic depression back home and was consequently without funds. Among the others also residing at the Stockade was Winthrop Sargent, who had earlier made a concerted effort to introduce himself to Ichabod Nye when Ichabod first arrived, and who did no less now in welcoming the Tupper family. Sargent was impressive, if not altogether likable. Tall and slender, always elegant in attire, he had the erect military stance of a high-ranking officer that seemed a bit out of place on the frontier, and a voice that could turn somewhat harsh, even when discussing matters pleasing to him. Particularly to those not from New England, he seemed the perfect stiff-necked Yankee, and would doubtless remain so. But then, like Manasseh Cutler, he was an avid botanist and took serious interest in Marietta's prehistoric mound. As a gardener, he surpassed everyone in the settlement. Sargent had grown up in Gloucester, Massachusetts, the son of a wealthy merchant, and while a student at Harvard, ran into trouble. As recorded in a faculty report, he had chosen to entertain two women of ill fame, who were seen at his chamber early the next morning, in such circumstances as indicate a strong presumption that they were kept there the whole night. On other occasions, the report continued, he fired pistols in the town of Cambridge in such a manner as to endanger the lives and property of the inhabitants. Dismissed from Harvard, Sargent was soon readmitted to the class of 1771 after his father made a substantial contribution toward the restoration of Harvard Hall. The next 4 years following graduation were spent at sea on his father's ships. He then served as an officer in Washington's army through the Revolution, after which he returned to Gloucester to find the family fortune ruined by the fickleness of privateering. In his role as secretary of the Ohio Company, Sargent had received an annual salary of $750. At Marietta came another $750 a year as second in command with the title of Secretary of the Territory. In little time, he began actively courting General Tupper's 22-year-old daughter, Rowena, and apparently with the full approval of her family, except for Ichabod Nye, who had by now decided Sargent was a consummate tyrant and rascal. Others, though, heartily approved the match. On hearing of a pending wedding, Manasseh Cutler wrote to offer his congratulations to Sargent for choosing such an amiable and agreeable young lady. Matrimony, he had thought, was the only prospect that could frighten Sargent. But true bravery rises superior to every hazard. The young lady has certainly done herself great honor in the conquest she has made. On February 6, 1789, at the stockade, with Rufus Putnam presiding, Rowena Tupper and Winthrop Sargent were married at what was thought to have been the first formal wedding ceremony among the settlers known to have taken place in all the Northwest Territory. But no sooner were they married, according to Ichabod Nye, than Sargent put on his true character, turning ever more imperious and haughty. He broke off all contact with General Tupper and the family, which was most mortifying and trying to the general, who doted on his daughter. That General Tupper liked to drink was no secret, nor by any means an unusual or unacceptable indulgence on the frontier at all levels. But Sargent had no tolerance for such indulgence. Tupper was a slave to whiskey, Sargent informed Manasseh Cutler, in a letter in which he also turned quite unkind in what he wrote about Rowena. While crediting her for her devotion to his happiness, he went on to describe her as plain, nor so graceful or accomplished as many fine ladies of my acquaintance. But then, he implied, what was one to do there in the backwoods with so little to choose from? Meantime, he had built a comfortable house for her, where sadly, less than a year after their marriage, on January 29, 1790, Rowena Tupper Sargent died in childbirth, as did the child. Despite the lack of flour and the Indians driving off the game, the settlers survived. With the return of spring, the gloom of the wilderness winter soon vanished. In the words of Ichabod Nye, spring opened with much activity. The return of traffic on the river not only meant the return of food supplies, but the return of the tide of humanity. New emigrants kept arriving in considerable numbers, which meant more farmers to clear and prepare more land, but also an increasing supply of skilled carpenters, gunsmiths, saddlers, glassmakers, weavers, bootmakers, blacksmiths, all much in need. William Moulton alone, a blacksmith from New Hampshire, as an example, fulfilled a multitude of essential needs. As one scholar of frontier life has written, the blacksmith was gunsmith, farrier, coppersmith, millwright, machinist, and surgeon general to all broken tools and implements. His forge was a center of social as well as industrial activity. From soft bar iron Nails as well as horseshoes were forged as needed. Chains, reaping hooks, bullet molds, yoke rings, axes, bear and wolf traps, hoes, augers, bells, saws, and the metal parts of looms, spinning wheels, sausage grinders, presses, and agricultural implements were a few of the items either manufactured or repaired in his shop. Moulton served also as a goldsmith, Captain Joseph Prince, a hatter, Moses Morse, a sign painter, whose tavern signs were all noted for featuring a black horse. It was said his road from New England to the Ohio River could be traced all the way by tavern signs he painted, thereby paying his traveling expenses. Most importantly, there were more women now to share in the endless work and hardships of life on the frontier. Pioneering demanded joint effort in just about everything. In the words of an old folk song, "'Tis I can delve and plow, love, and you can spin and sew, and we'll settle on the banks of the pleasant Ohio." As Ichabod Nye would write, "The women put up with all these inconveniences with spirit and fortitude not often excelled by men." The center of pioneer life was the home, where, in the old saying, a woman's work was never done, from first light to setting sun. There were no days off, no vacations. Besides cooking, baking, cleaning, and the full-time role of wife and mother, there were cows to milk, gardens to tend, candles and soap to be made, butter to churn. As would be said, working butter with wooden paddles in the large wooden bowl, molding it, and cleaning the pails and utensils was as much a part of women's work as washing dishes. Butter was a major element of the frontier diet, and making good butter was a skill in which women took particular pride. Then there was yarn to spin, wool to weave, clothes to make for large families, clothes to wash, mend, and patch. And just as the man of the house had his axe, plowshare, long rifle, and those other tools necessary for the work to be faced, so too did the woman of the house. Knives, needles, spoons, paddles, hickory brooms, spinning wheels, and most important, the bulbous heavy iron pots to be seen in nearly every cabin that were used more for cooking than any other item and led to countless aching backs by the end of the day. In contrast to the many surviving letters and journals by the men who came west, first-person accounts by the pioneer women are disappointingly scarce, and even they record little of the struggles and hardships faced. There was, it would seem, widespread reluctance on the part of women to subject those they loved back home to any of their troubles or fears or regrets. One notable exception was Lucy Backus Woodbridge, who, over the years, wrote quite often to her parents and others of her family in Connecticut. But even then, it was primarily to say how intensely she missed them. She had been one of those who arrived at Marietta in the autumn of 1789. Her husband, Dudley Woodbridge, a Yale graduate, with James Backus, had been the two who established Marietta's first general store. She was 32 and the mother of 6 children, the youngest 4 of whom had come west, while the older 2 remained in Connecticut to continue their education. She had grown up in a family of some means and in one of the larger, more luxurious houses in the town of Norwich, and in little time in Marietta, the general store prospered. So the struggle for survival on the frontier was not for her as it was for so many. But when she wrote, as she did, of her longing for home and her family there, she was speaking for many another woman. When her younger brother, Elijah, who had also come west, reported the adversities of age their parents were going through, she wrote to tell them, "I never so severely felt the pain of being separated from you. Your confinement and suffering excite sensations that are never to be expressed. about all she could offer in the way of her own outlook, was to say she was confident her prospects there on the frontier were much better than I had any reason to expect had I continued in New England. In conclusion, she said simply what so many New Englanders were raised on and was taken to heart by so many of the women there on the banks of the Ohio. I will not afflict you with complaining. As things were to go, it would be nearly 2 years later when she could honestly report, and with apparent surprise, that she had come to like this country. As she wrote to a brother, "I am happy to feel my attachment for this place and its inhabitants strengthen with the affectionate attentions I have met from my old neighbors." Conspicuous loafing. Loafing of almost any kind was as yet unknown. Everyone worked, including children. It had to be so for survival. Come spring, there were crops to be sown. Through summer and into fall, there were crops to be harvested, and always more land needed to be cleared. Winter was a struggle in itself. The attire of women was invariably all of a kind, homemade, plain, and simple of necessity. The male pioneer, too, dressed as called for, often as not in the same work clothes he had worn back in New England, but increasingly, as time passed, the wardrobe evolved into that of the frontiersman, consisting primarily of a long linen shirt and pantaloons produced by wives or daughters or female friends. The rest was nearly all buckskin, moccasins, leggings or gaiters, these for defense against rattlesnakes, and hunting shirt. Hats varied, but were mainly of the broad-brimmed kind. The impression the settlement at Marietta made on those seeing it for the first time often depended on the eyes of the beholder. One of those newly arrived was overcome with disappointment, even despair, by what he saw. On ascending the bank of the river to look at the town we had been nearly 3 months toiling to see, a very cheerless prospect was presented to our view. A few log huts were scattered here and there, raised only a few feet above the tall stumps of the sturdy trees that had been cut away to make room for them. Narrow footpaths meandered through the mud and water from cabin to cabin, while an occasional log across the watercourses afforded a pedestrian a passage without wetting his feet. However, John May, who returned to Marietta that summer of 1789, after an absence of a year, saw things differently. Astonished by all the improvements, he spent the whole of one Saturday reconnoitering the settlement. "I find about 60 good buildings, many of which are large and handsome," he wrote. "There were at least 400 acres of corn as good as ever was seen, and would," he estimated, "produce 20,000 bushels of grain." On Sunday, he attended a public service to hear the new pastor, a slender young man from Massachusetts, the Reverend Daniel Story, who had been selected for the role by Manasseh Cutler, and who, May was happy to record, provided a very good performance. But as May also recorded, he found himself growing weary of the howling wilderness, and when, on reuniting with his family back east, he was told they had no desire to settle in Ohio, he too gave up on the idea and did not return. Ichabod Nye, by now, had come to the end of his rope. Having concluded he would never amount to a hill of beans, he had taken stock of the little he had left in the way of material assets: 2 old horses, 1 old watch, 2 barrels of flour purchased from Dean Tyler, and some 25 pounds of shoe leather. "These," he would write, "were all the resources which I could bring into action for the maintenance of my family." So he had decided to make the best of his hands and took up patching and making shoes, little knowing at first how to go about it or where it might lead. In fact, as neither he nor anyone else could have imagined, it would lead to great success with Marietta's first tannery. Ichabod Nye, the man who had so wished he had never come west, was soon writing to a brother back home, urging him to pack up and come join him. With all the concentrated activity, the tangible progress to be seen, there still remain the hard realities of the frontier. The life left behind back east, families and friends, was as distant, as out of reach as ever. Not only were letters from home rare, but news of any kind was still rare, still painfully slow to arrive. The news that in April, on a balcony at Federal Hall in New York, George Washington had taken the oath of office as the first president of the United States took more than a month reaching Marietta. Measureless wilderness on all sides, and the continuing fears and uncertainties over the native people so close at hand, remained a constant presence. It was the great overshadowing fact of life on the frontier, and was made even more unnerving by two events that summer of 1789. In early July, a surveying party led by John Matthews, working the lower part of the Ohio Company's purchase, suffered the loss of two pack horses, which apparently had strayed off into the woods, with the result that the party also suffered a serious loss of provisions. The men had to get by on meat alone, or what little there was to be found, until, after 9 or 10 days, they were forced to return to Marietta. On the trip back up the Ohio, they met with Generals Tupper and Parsons, and a number of others coming downstream on a reconnoitering expedition, and who requested that Matthews and his party turn back and complete their unfinished work. To make this possible, they sent a messenger to Marietta for provisions. As would be said of John Matthews, his energy always increased with the difficulties of his situation. He knew that in the frontier expression, he and his men were in danger pretty considerable much. He had been told many times by old scouts that anyone who ventured continually into dangerous country would, sooner or later, run into trouble. He was also well aware of the particular hostility Indians had for surveyors, knowing they were the ones preparing the way for still more white invaders. All the same, Matthews and his party, which included a number of soldiers, returned to their assignment only to have another horse disappear. This time, however, they discovered moccasin tracks in several places. The explanation was clear. Early the morning of August 7th, as Matthews was sitting on his blanket undressed, two guns were fired by an unseen enemy. One of his men, sitting beside him, was shot through the chest. "Oh, God, I am killed," he exclaimed. At that instant, a second volley was fired at a cluster of 6 or 7 soldiers, all but one of whom were killed. As a swarm of Indians rushed upon their victims on one side of the camp, Matthews and 3 others of his men fled off on the other side. In a later account, Matthews is described as having escaped with nothing on but his hat and shirt. He and another comrade ran for their lives. Seeing Matthews' condition, the other man offered him his coat, which Matthews managed to pull on by slipping his legs into the sleeves. They raced on for 7 or 8 miles, until Matthews' bare feet were so torn and blistered he could only walk, and then in searing pain. After reaching the banks of the Ohio, they had almost succeeded in building a raft out of old logs bound together with grapevines, when an Ohio Company boat and crew came in sight and took them on board and back to safety. 1 week later, Matthews and a party of armed men returned to the scene of the calamity to recover the remains of 9 dead soldiers. "He found them lying near where they fell," an old account continues. "The flesh was all eaten from their bones by the wolves. except that on the palms of their hands and soles of the feet. To which parts of the human body they, as well as dogs, seem to have an instinctive aversion. To which tribe the killers belonged was never determined for certain, but they were thought to have been Shawnees. The second event, or incident, though far from so tragic in its consequences, nonetheless made a lasting impression among those who heard about it, and particularly on the mothers of overly adventurous children. It involved a party of only one, Jervis Cutler, who had returned to the settlement that fall after more than a year back in western Pennsylvania teaching school. He had joined another surveying party between the Big Hockhocking River and Raccoon Creek. That he had been one of the first pioneers to land at Marietta, indeed by reputation the first to have leapt ashore, made what happened now such a surprise, and to him no less than to others. Having quite a relish for hunting, and an expert with a rifle, as he himself said, he had set off into the woods one morning accompanied only by a small dog, and to his surprise soon found himself altogether lost. And so it remained until nightfall, and all through the following day, as well as the day after and the day after that. Because of his skill with a rifle, he and the dog survived on one deer, a turkey, and a little half-starved opossum. But not for fully 8 days did he finally find his way out of the woods and back with the surveyors. Not surprisingly, the story spread far. As serious as had been the need for food through the previous winter, concern over the problem seemed to have slipped out of mind. The spring and summer of 1789 proved ideal for growing just about everything. Turnips, cabbages, and radishes were up in gardens as early as March. The midsummer corn crop was all that could be hoped for. Beans, tomatoes, and potatoes were in abundance, and a second crop of corn was doing as well or better than the first. Normally, Indian summer was the prime time of the year, but not this year. On the first day of October, an early frost struck throughout much of the northwest country, killing most of the corn when it was not quite out of the soft, succulent stage called the milk. Many thought that if dried out, it could make good bread. Instead, it produced sickness and vomiting. It could not even be fed to animals with safety. Were this not enough? In November came a serious outbreak of measles in Marietta that would take the lives of a number of children. The year had started with the death of General James Varnum. Now, in mid-November, General Samuel Parsons was killed trying to shoot the rapids in a canoe on the Beaver River, which joined the Ohio northwest of Pittsburgh. A companion in the canoe, Captain Joseph Rogers, escaped with his life. As a soldier, patriot, lawyer, as a director of the Ohio Company and chief judge of the Western Territory, General Parsons had been a figure of considerable importance through much of his life. For the pioneers of Marietta, his death was an altogether unexpected blow. 2. Joseph Barker was 24 years old, raised in New Hampshire. He was descended from a long line of weavers, saddlers, and farmers. His father, Deacon Ephraim Barker, was a highly respected housewright and church builder, and for years served as deacon and musician in his church in Amherst, New Hampshire. The second of 10 children, Joseph had been sent away to school until age 14, when he was brought home again to begin work as his father's apprentice. Thus it was that the carpenter's trade became his own, and he had become exceptionally skilled at it. Tall and strong, he was also known for his athletic abilities, his humor, and cheerful outlook. He loved to read, and in time was to show considerable skill as a writer, though, like Rufus Putnam and numerous others of the time, proper spelling was more than he could handle. He spelled canoe, C-A-N-O-O, large, L-E-A-R-G-E. The word excellent he did with no C and only one L. Thus it came out E-X-E-L-E-N-T. Seldom became S-I-L-D-O-M, Sildom, which may have been how he pronounced it. But apparently, none of this mattered much to him or to others. In September 1789, Joseph married 19-year-old Elizabeth Dana of Amherst, the daughter of Captain William and Mary Bancroft Dana. Less than 2 years earlier, his financial state shattered by the depreciation of the currency, Captain Dana had set off with two of his sons for the Ohio country to see about settling there. When Captain Dana returned to bring the rest of the family west, Joseph and his bride decided to go with them. The journey proved more difficult than they had imagined. At times, crossing the Alleghenies, progress became so slow, their wagons had to be taken apart and the separate pieces carried by hand over impassable barriers of rocks and ledges. After crossing the mountains to Cimarron's Ferry and waiting for an unwieldy boat to be built for them, they proceeded down the Ohio. Instead of landing at Marietta, they went on to a newly established settlement of about 24 families downstream on the Ohio side of the river called Belpre. There, Captain Dana's land was located, but on arrival, they found the cabin he built the year before had, by accident, burned to the ground. As a consequence, young Joseph decided to stay, for the time being, at Marietta, where carpenters were much in demand. Winter had set in by then, and troubles were all about. As serious as had been the shortage of food the previous winter, this one was to be worse. The starving year, and the suffering extreme. Because of the slaughter of the wild game by the Indians, the woods were still bare within a radius of 20 miles. There were other explanations as well, the clearing of the forests and the hunting by the settlers, and as Joseph Barker put it, a large majority of the emigrants had strewed all their money on the mountains of Pennsylvania, and in the enjoyment that they had got to the land of promise, they forgot to provide for the future. In fact, there were many causes of the hungry year, as it was also called, and in many other sections of the country, including New England, most of them not readily apparent in Ohio. France had been importing unprecedented quantities of wheat and flour from the United States. Then there was the devastating effect of the insect called the Hessian fly on wheat production. Climate historians would later attribute a large part of the problem to major volcanic explosions in Iceland and Japan that blew millions of tons of particles into the upper atmosphere, thereby reducing the warming of sunlight on a good part of the globe. What saved the settlement was generosity. To Barker, it was a powerful lesson in life. "Where poverty, improvidence, and scarcity meet," he wrote, "charity and benevolence only could give relief." Later, Marietta's earliest historian, Samuel P. Hildreth, was to write, "In this great scarcity, it was wonderful how little there was of selfishness, and how generally kindness and good feeling abounded. Those who had more resources lent or gave to those who had less." One family in particular came to the rescue in a way never forgotten. Isaac and Rebecca Williams, emigrant farmers from Pennsylvania, who had settled on the Virginia side of the Ohio across from Marietta, were known and admired for their consistently abundant harvests. To those now starving, Mr. Williams sold his corn at the usual price of 50 cents a bushel, instead of the then going price of $2.50. To the desperately poor, he let them have it without payment. To speculators who offered to buy all he had, he refused to sell even a bushel. Joseph Barker, in his later reminiscences, would recount how two heads of families told Williams they had no bread and had come to get what corn they could with the little money they had. "How many is there of you?" said Mr. Williams, in Joseph Barker's account. "Rising of 20," was the reply. "Dang it," says the old man, "there is a heap of you, but you must have half a bushel apiece." And they had. Those who had cows, wrote historian Hildreth, divided the milk with their neighbors, especially where there were children. Sugar or molasses they had little of, as they had not kettles to boil the sap of the maple. The Ohio Company, with a liberality worthy of all praise, assisted many poor families with small loans of money, or the suffering would have been much greater. With this, they could occasionally get provisions from boats descending the Ohio. The matrons of the colony, in a little sober chit-chat over a cup of spice bush tea, without any sugar and very little milk, concluded if they lived ever again to enjoy a supply of wholesome food for their children and selves, they would never complain of their fare, be it ever so coarse and homely. That November came an outbreak of measles in Marietta that would take the lives of still more children. To add further to the miseries, a sick man and his family were put ashore from a boat heading downriver to Kentucky, and his trouble proved to be the ever-dreaded smallpox, which had not made its appearance until then. A town meeting was called at the stockade. A separate log cabin was quickly put up for the sick man, and Nurse Mary Owen, the first woman to settle in Marietta, took up her duties, only to contract the disease herself. When the sick man died, another town meeting was hurriedly called, and more cabins went up farther off, in back of the big cornfield on the plain, where more people could be inoculated and cared for, and among them was Joseph Barker. To his wife, Elizabeth, who remained in Belpre, where it was thought to be safer, he was happy to report, "I am living in a little, clean log cabin that is 6 feet wide, 7 feet long, and 4.5 high. We make out to sit up, but cannot stand straight." Complaints he had none. "We lodge very well." 6 more died of the disease. 2 of the 100 or more inoculated also died. Much to the relief of the many who knew her, Mary Owen recovered to live many more years, though with evidence of what she had been through marking her face. Joseph Barker, too, lived on. At the start of the new year, 1790, Governor Arthur St. Clair took up residence with his family in the southwestern blockhouse of the stockade. Newly finished quarters with, as Carpenter Barker proudly noted, "good smooth poplar floors, doors, casings, etc., and a brick chimney with 3 fireplaces below and 3 above." With the return of spring, families scoured the woods for edible weeds and herbs, nettles or purslane, which was preferred. They collected the tender shoots of pigeonberry and potatoes. Then came the earliest of the garden vegetables, peas, beans, radishes, squash, followed by what turned out to be a bumper crop of corn. By early July, the famine had ended. The settlement had survived. And for all the difficulties still to be faced, the supply of food was not to be one of them ever again. Rather, there were to be continuing ample surpluses to sell. That March, Rufus Putnam had been appointed territorial judge by President Washington as the replacement for General Samuel Parsons. And this, along with the bright prospects that returned with spring, led him to conclude it was time at long last to bring his family west to the settlement. A handsome, new, decidedly New England-looking home with clapboard siding, brick fireplaces, 4 bedrooms, an attic, was ready for them at the stockade. In June, he headed back to Rutland to lead another westward expedition, including this time his wife, 2 sons, and 5 daughters, as well as some 15 others who had contracted Ohio fever. 2 men, hired as teamsters, two wagons, two yoke of oxen, and half a dozen cattle. One of the Rufus Putnam wagons was loaded with as many as 50 varieties of apple seeds, as one of the requirements of the Ohio Company stipulated that settlers plant an orchard of that many apple trees. While in Massachusetts, Putnam had written to Manasseh Cutler, urging him to come to Marietta. "Your company is much wished for by the best people." But Cutler, immersed in his pastoral duties, his school, his numerous intellectual pursuits, was not to return, then or ever again. The journey of Putnam and his family took 8 weeks. "At length we arrived at Marietta about 9 in the morning, remembered one of the party. All the settlers gave us a hearty welcome. For Joseph Barker, family life was just getting started. His wife, Elizabeth, who was still living downriver at Belpre with her father and mother, had given birth to a son, Joseph Jr., and that spring he had moved them to be with him in Marietta. Fully employed now by Rufus Putnam, he was building pickets at the stockade where, in December 1790, he and his family moved in. Also, as was expected of all men fit to serve, Barker had joined the Marietta Militia. The territorial law made it the duty of the troops to assemble at the stockade parade ground for inspection every Sunday morning at 10. After this, with fife and drum, Generals Putnam and Tupper and Colonel Big Buckeye Sproat in the lead, sword drawn, would march to the place of public service in the Northwest Blockhouse. As he was proud to explain, Barker had been made orderly sergeant. It was his role to keep attendance. Call every man's name, examine their arms and ammunition, note down and report delinquencies. In case of an alarm, those who were armed among the congregation were to rush out of the meeting to face the danger. In remarkably little time, a matter of mere months, young Barker had taken a notable place in the community as both a highly skilled worker and a dutiful citizen. 3. Serious trouble of a different kind had been festering beneath the surface for some 3 years, all the way back to the agreement reached with Congress on the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, that in addition to the Ohio Company, there would be a speculative real estate venture called the Scioto Company, involving more than 4 million acres farther down the Ohio to the confluence of the Scioto River. In the time since, the Scioto Company had come under suspicion. For some unknown reason, William Dewar, the Secretary of the Board of Treasury and originator of the Scioto idea, put in place as the company's sales agent a gentlemanly Connecticut lawyer, Joel Barlow, who was also known as a poet. Barlow went off to France to market the Scioto land and there took on a business partner named William Playfair, whom he described as an Englishman of a bold and enterprising spirit and a good imagination. As it turned out, Playfair did not play fair. In Marietta were several people, like James Varnum, who had been angry at Manasseh Cutler, not because the Scioto Company was a mistake or an enterprise of questionable integrity, but because they had not been included, and told him so. Deeply offended, Cutler insisted he had done nothing inappropriate, and by all evidence, he had not. In a heartfelt letter to Rufus Putnam, dated November 18, 1788, Cutler declared, "I view my character as much dearer than my life. And the man who would deprive me of it, I consider infinitely worse than a highway robber. For it is what cannot be restored, especially in a matter of public trust." In France, Barlow and Playfair prepared a prospectus on the rivers Ohio and Scioto, and including Cutler's earlier pamphlet, along with numerous additions and embellishments. Playfair's good imagination had been put to work. Not surprisingly, no mention was made of freezing winters, or starvation, or smallpox, or the threat posed by the native tribes. Instead, it was a climate altogether wholesome and delightful, frost even in winter almost entirely unknown. There was venison in plenty, the pursuit of which is uninterrupted by wolves, foxes, lions, or tigers. Added to that, there were no taxes to pay, no military services to be performed. In 1789, France was in the early throes of revolution, and as a French geographer would write, nothing was talked of in every social circle but the paradise that was open to Frenchmen in the Western wilderness, the free and happy life to be led on the blissful banks of the Ohio. Sales of Scioto land went fast, and in February 1790, some 600 French emigrants, men, women, and a few children, believing they owned land in the Ohio paradise, boarded 5 chartered ships and sailed for America. After 3 months at sea, they landed at Alexandria, Virginia, on the 1st of May, only to discover they had been defrauded. The Scioto Company owned no land in Ohio and had no money to pay Congress for it. William Playfair had made off with the money they invested and disappeared. Joel Barlow, it seems, had also been duped by him. So the land belongs still to the government of the United States. The Scioto Company and William Duer had failed. Only Duer could be held accountable, and when President Washington intervened to tell Duer something must be done at once, Duer arranged for Rufus Putnam to prepare to receive the emigrants on Ohio Company lands, to erect the necessary buildings, and in addition, provide sufficient provisions for a year, which they, Duer and Putnam, were to wind up paying themselves out of their own funds. In mid-October, after an arduous journey overland and downstream on the Ohio on 6 Kentucky flatboats, the French pilgrims, literally strangers in a strange land, arrived finally at Marietta. Some would choose to stay. The rest proceeded downstream to a point 3 miles below the mouth of the Kanawha River, which was to be their new home. To the local populace, not surprisingly, they were an immense curiosity. Exhausted, out of sorts, they grumbled on effusively in rapid French, such as never heard in Marietta. "There might have been more tongues at Babel," commented Joseph Barker, "but they never went faster." Wanting no delay in the establishment of the new colony downriver, Rufus Putnam brought in a crew of 40 men to make a clearing and build 80 rough log cabins in 4 rows, 20 to a row, and a high stockade fence with 2-story blockhouses at each corner. It was, as said, a primitive little frontier village facing the river. The cabins had dirt floors only. Deep forests closed in on 3 sides. Much there was still to be done, and in background and working skills, the emigrants who came ashore were hardly prepared. They were French artisans, artists, craftsmen, jewelers, hatters, watchmakers, silversmiths, city people from Paris and Lyon. A few were noblemen. Hardly any had ever held an axe or a gun before or skinned an animal. But if they knew nothing of gardening, some had brought books on the subject from France. Still, most were optimistic and with pride named their settlement Gallipolis, City of Gauls, or Frenchtown, as Americans would refer to it. Whether it could survive remained to be seen. When it came to clearing more of the land back from the river, their initial struggles to find the best way were to be long remembered by locals. "I have seen 6 at work in taking down a tree," wrote one witness, "some pulling ropes fastened to the branches, while others were cutting around it like beavers. Several of the Frenchmen were killed when crushed by trees they were cutting down. Though many of the French would give up and move on to settle elsewhere, far more remained, grateful for the new life, given what they had left behind, and confident, even optimistic, about the future. As one wrote, "To some, the surrounding woods might appear frightful deserts. To me, they are the paradise of nature. No hosts of greedy priests, no seas of blood to wade through. All is quiet." The Scioto Company left the French settlers largely to fend for themselves. William Duer, creator of the Scioto Company, would wind up in debtor's prison until his death in 1797. Meantime, significant changes had taken place in Marietta. Arthur St. Clair had decided to move the office of the territory governor farther west, down the Ohio, to a village known as Los Santaville, meaning town located opposite the mouth of the Licking, a name St. Clair promptly changed to Cincinnati, in honor of the famous Revolutionary Officers' Society. There also the army had begun construction of Fort Washington as a base of operations against the Indians. Winthrop Sargent, too, as Secretary of the Territory, now chose to make his home in Cincinnati, a move he was to regret, finding the cost of living, an uncultured, low moral tone of the place, hard for him to bear. To compensate, it would seem, he took greater interest than ever in botany and the historic mounds of Cincinnati, and spent time with increasing correspondence with the naturalist Joseph Bartram and the Massachusetts Historical Society. On Monday, December 20th, 1790, Rufus Putnam sat down to write a long and important letter to President Washington. "It was as late as the 5th of November before I arrived here with my family, since which I have been so busily engaged in preparing for the winter that I have not been able to attend minutely to any other subject. But in general, I have observed that our crops have been very fine, that the spirit of industry and enterprise among the people is as great as ever, and the improvements and buildings which have been made are truly surprising." He reported also that the emigrants from France had arrived and were settling in, but it appeared they were not calculated for the meridian of the woods. From there, he moved on to what had become his overriding concern. "As to Indian matters, we are fearful that the spring will open by a general attack on the frontiers, unless prevented by government carrying a war into the enemy's country. It is possible that the Shawnees, etc., may be for peace, but I consider it very doubtful. From all the circumstances which I have been able to collect respecting the late campaign, I do not believe the Indians have had sufficient drubbing to induce them to ask a peace, and every day I am more and more confirmed in this opinion by the Delawares and other Indians keeping aloof." The late campaign referred to had taken place that fall, well to the west on the Miami River, and had been a disaster that only made the situation worse. A makeshift frontier army of almost 1,500 men, regulars and militia, under the command of General Josiah Harmer, had set out to punish the Miami and Shawnees. Harmer was known to be a drinker, prone to indulge to excess in a convivial glass, as his friend Secretary of War Henry Knox expressed it. Both Knox and President Washington had been greatly concerned about this, and as it turned out, Harmer and his men were soundly defeated by a much smaller force led by the Miami war chief, Little Turtle. Of the regulars and militia, 183 were dead or missing. The Indian loss had been fewer than a dozen. One regular officer called the militia's behavior scandalous. Many of the militiamen, he said, never fired a shot but ran off and left a few regulars to be sacrificed. Some of them never halted until they crossed the Ohio. Even more ominous to Rufus Putnam, as he stressed to the president, was the vanished presence of the numerous Delawares and Wyandots, who for so long had been part of the everyday life in the settlement. Except for two familiar women, none was to be seen any longer, and word was they had reason to move north, some 80 miles up the Muskingum. Trouble was coming. Of this, Putnam was certain. "When or where it will fall, God only knows," he continued in his letter to the president. "But I trust, sir, that in the multiplicity of public concerns which claim your attention, our little colony will not be forgotten." I believe you will not think me vain and presumptuous when I say that the inhabitants that compose this settlement have as great a claim to protectionism as any under the federal government. A great proportion of us served our country through the war, and being good subjects in general, as well as being disposed to live in friendship with our savage neighbors, if possible. Less than 2 weeks later, on Sunday, January 2, 1791, a calamity such as Rufus Putnam so feared took place on the eastern bank of the Muskingum, 30 miles upstream from Marietta. The location was called Big Bottom, for the generous size of the rich bottomland at that point along the river, which gave it great appeal as a place for a settlement. Even so, Putnam and others of the Ohio Company strongly opposed any venturing out that far at this time. Moreover, those determined to establish themselves there were young and little acquainted with native warfare. But impatient to get started, and confident in their ability to cope with whatever they had to face, the young settlers went ahead. All were single men from New England, except for one Virginian, an experienced hunter with a wife and two children. They put up a log blockhouse that, in an emergency, could accommodate them all, and in doing this made the first of several crucial mistakes. They failed to chink the building between the logs. That the weather was extremely cold, the river frozen, may explain this in part. The second mistake was posting no sentry after dark, and for this there was no excuse. Nor had any dogs been left outside to sound an alarm. There was little or no order. Rifles were left lying about in different places. No system of defense had been worked out. Two nearby cabins housed four other men, Francis and Isaac Choate in one, Asa and Eleazar Bullard in the other. It would be said that the raiding party of Delawares and Wyandots that arrived on the old path on the opposite side of the river on the afternoon of Sunday, January 2nd, had not been aware of there being a settlement at Big Bottom. From the ridge, reads an account by Samuel Hildreth, they had a view of all that part of the bottom and could see how the men were occupied and the defenseless condition of the blockhouse. After completing their reconnaissance and holding a council as to the mode of attack, they crossed the river on the ice a little above and divided their warriors into two divisions, the larger one to assault the blockhouse and the smaller one to make prisoners of the men in the upper cabin without alarming those below. The plan was skillfully arranged and promptly executed. At the Choate cabin, the raiders found those inside at supper. A few of the Indians stepped through the door in a friendly manner and were offered something to eat. They at once pounced on and bound the settlers and told them they were prisoners. At the blockhouse, the slaughter took but minutes. One stout Indian smashed open the door and stood by to keep it open, while others outside opened fire through the unchinked logs. The inhabitants had also been at supper. One man, Zebulon Troop from Massachusetts, was frying meat and fell dead in the fire. Several others fell at the discharge. The Indians then rushed in and killed the rest with tomahawks. Everything happened so fast there was no resistance, except for the wife of the Virginian, Isaac Meeks, a stout backwoods woman who, seeing her husband shot dead and her children killed with tomahawks, seized an axe and, in rage, struck a blow at the head of the Indian who opened the door. Only a slight turn of the head saved his skull, and her axe sliced through his cheek and into the shoulder. She was instantly killed with the tomahawk of another of the Indians. A young man named John Stacy tried to escape out a window. When spotted by Indians outside as he clambered onto the roof, he begged to be spared, saying he was the only one left. They shot and killed him. After the slaughter ended, the scalps taken, and the raiders proceeded to round up the plunder, 16-year-old Philip Stacy was discovered hiding under a pile of bedding in the corner of the room. He, it was decided, would be spared, and along with the two Choates, taken away as captives. As for the Bullards, they, at the first sound of the Indians near their cabin, had snatched up their rifles and barely escaped out the door and into the woods. It was they who would sound the alarm. 14 people had been killed in the attack. Before leaving the scene, the raiders piled up the bodies and lit the blockhouse on fire, and expecting all traces of what had taken place to go up in flame, they went on their way. But it was a building of still green logs, and except for the floor and roof, it did not burn. Neither did the bodies, though most were charred and blackened beyond recognition. Word of the massacre spread rapidly and struck terror as nothing had since the first settlers came ashore at the point. "The time had come," said Rufus Putnam, "to prepare for the worst."